This podcast is about your future. What if the next years of your life can be the best years of your life? When full-time work becomes optional, you'll have the time to do all the things you've always wanted to do, if only you had the time, and soon you will. But to make the most of it, you'll need to be well prepared, and that goes well beyond your financial planning. Each week, your host, Joe Casey, is inviting you into conversations with his guests to bring you insights, inspiration, and practical ideas to design your new life, a life you'll build around what matters most to you and on your own terms. Let's get started.
Welcome to today's podcast conversation. As we get older, many things change. Some of our abilities inevitably decline, and new challenges pop up sometimes, it seems like, every day. But at the same time, new capabilities begin to emerge. We begin to see things in a different way. And new opportunities present themselves if we're open to them and we're open to change. But there's a transition we need to go through. And my guest today is going to share his experiences and 8 years of research on the two curves of life and what it takes to find purpose, greater meaning, and satisfaction in the second half of life. What do we need to pick up and what do we need to let go of? Arthur C. Brooks is the William Henry Bloomberg Professor of the Practice of Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School and Professor of Management Practice at the Harvard Business School. Before joining the Harvard faculty in July of 2019, he served for 10 years as the president of Washington, D.C.-based American Enterprise Institute, AEI, one of the world's leading think tanks. He's the author of 11 books, including the national bestsellers, Love Your Enemies, The Conservative Heart, and The Road to Freedom. He has also published dozens of academic journal articles and the textbook Social Entrepreneurship in 2008. He is a columnist for The Atlantic, host of the podcast The Art of Happiness with Arthur Brooks, and the subject of the 2019 documentary film The Pursuit, which Variety named as one of the best documentaries on Netflix in August 2019. He gives more than 100 speeches per year around the U.S., Europe, and Asia. He's here to discuss his new book, From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Joe. It's great to be with you.
So I vividly remember where I was and when I read your article, Your Professional Decline is Coming Much Sooner Than You Think.
You remember where you were, like the Kennedy assassination almost, huh?
That title really got me. And then I realized I was already past my professional decline. But it really had a big impact on me. And it's not a theoretical piece. And I was wondering if you could share your story of the transition you made as a CEO and the years of reflection and research that's led to your new book, From Strength to Strength.
Yeah. So the book, the article that you're referring to is a feature article I wrote in The Atlantic in July of 2019. Which was actually the fruit of about 8 years of research, private research. So I'm a social scientist, and at the time I was the head of a think tank, a very academic think tank in Washington, D.C. called the American Enterprise Institute, and was supervising a lot of PhD people doing important work and all that. But and things were going great. I was in my late 40s at the time when I was doing this, and you know, my career was going really well, and it was economically rewarding, et cetera, et cetera. But I had this sneaking sensation, Joe, that I wasn't going to be able to keep this up. As a matter of fact, I started to notice that things that used to be easy for me were starting to get hard. And there was no cognitive decline. I mean, for Pete's sake, I was still a young man. But I noticed that just idea things were coming to younger people much easier than they were to me. And I thought, what's up with this? So I decided I was going to undertake a research project, but it was actually that I had this very vivid experience that kicked it off. I was on an airplane and I heard this guy, old man, probably his 80s, telling his wife that he wished he thought he were dead. And his wife saying, it's not true that nobody cares about you anymore. And she was consoling him. And when the lights went on, because it was a nighttime flight, and I turned around, it was one of the most famous men in the world. This is somebody who's going to do 10 times as much with his career as I'll ever do with mine. And I thought to myself, wow, this is blowing my mind, because if I did one fraction of what that guy has done, I would be satisfied forever. And that's, of course, wrong. So I thought to myself, look, I know that I can't keep this party going. And even if I could, I don't want to end up like that. So what can I do now to retool my career and my concept of myself so that as I grow older, no matter what I'm doing for a living or not doing for a living, I have a fighting chance at being happier at 75 than I was at 45 and 55 and 65. What can I do? And I put my whole toolkit as a social scientist to work on this. I'm a happiness specialist, after all. And I worked on it for 8 years. It was like a surgeon taking out his own appendix. And at the end, I'd crack the code. To my satisfaction, I thought, well, I got to publish this as a book because I'm not going to be the only one consuming this. Somebody else has got to be interested in what they can do at 45 or 55 or 25 so they can be happier at 75. And this is an owner's manual on how to grow older.
So you mentioned that some things you notice are getting harder as we age. Definitely there are things that decline. But you point out there's another side to the story. Some things improve. What have you noticed declined and what's improving?
Well, I noticed that analysis and innovation get harder as we get older. And I started looking into why that was. And there's a whole body of research that shows that's something called fluid intelligence. Fluid intelligence is what makes you good at what you're good at. So you're a Wall Street guy, and what made you a good at your job was that you were able to answer other people's questions and solve other people's problems faster than anybody else. That's what makes you really good in the knowledge business, in the ideas business. And that gets easier and better through your 20s and into your 30s. And then in your late 30s, according to the research, that fluid intelligence, the ability to do that, actually starts to decline and is really in free fall in your 40s. That's why certain things for people who are in perfectly good health and have high levels of skill, they find their jobs getting harder and more challenging than it used to be. That's why lawyers find that in their 40s, that they're not as sharp as they were in their 30s. And surgeons find the same thing, whether they're willing to admit it or not. But here's the good news. Actually, the research shows that that's not your only intelligence. That's the first intelligence curve. Goes up, comes back down. But there's another intelligence curve behind it called the crystallized intelligence curve, which makes it much easier for you not to answer somebody else's questions, but to ask the right questions. You get much better at taking the information that's out there and assembling it into a coherent storyline and solving problems that way. Now, that's a different task. That's different than I'm going to answer your questions and solve your problems faster and better than anybody else. It's I'm going to go figure out what the right questions are. And then I'm going to put together a team that's going to solve them. It's a different discipline. You're basically going from innovator to instructor, from visionary inventor to master teacher. That's what the crystallized intelligence curve. And that goes up through your 40s and it goes up through your 50s and it stays high in your 60s and 70s and even your 80s. So as long as you've got your health and your marbles, you can be a sage, you can be a master teacher, you can be the Dalai Lama, basically is what it comes down to. But you got to jump from that first curve to the second curve.
So that jump can be really challenging. How do you explain the second curve in the transition point, that pivot point?
Well, the jump is hard because most people don't know that there's a second curve. They just know that they're feeling rotten and not doing as well as they used to. And so they start freaking out. They start raging against the dying of the light, to quote Dylan Thomas, the Welsh poet who wrote that famous, rage, rage against the dying of the light. And that's what people basically start doing because they don't know there's another curve behind it. They don't know they have another success curve, or they don't want to do something different. I like what I used to do, what I used to be really good at. That was my ego. That was my identity. Or they're too lazy to do it. But the truth is, if you have the faith and you've got the information, then you basically have to make a commitment to retool yourself, your career, your job. Now, for some people, it's really, really easy. If you're a college professor, you start emphasizing more your teaching than you are on your cutting edge research, for example. You start doing different kinds of writing where you're explaining ideas to bigger groups of people. I've gone from being a largely mathematical quantitative economist, doing really original quantitative research for like 14 people, to now I write a column at The Atlantic for 500,000 people a week. It's incredibly rewarding, but I'm not doing the original research. I'm harvesting the research of other people and explaining it to a mass audience because that's a crystallized intelligence task. But you've got to figure out some way to retool your activities. Now, some people have to quit their job and do another job. Some people have to go into a whole new career. Some people can just rededicate themselves to something that is different than it used to be, but within the context of the current job. So as we say, and you guys say on Wall Street, your results may vary.
Absolutely. So you write and teach about happiness. How do you define happiness?
Happiness is usually defined by people who aren't thinking about it very much as a feeling. So it's a feeling, it's good feelings, and then they kind of get stuck. And the truth is that happiness is not a feeling any more than your Thanksgiving dinner is the smell of the dinner. The feelings are actually a product They're a side effect of the actual phenomenon. And happiness really is kind of it's an amalgam of three macronutrients. So just as food is made up of proteins, carbohydrates, and fat, happiness is a combination of enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose. Those are the three macronutrients that go into happiness. And you find that people say that they're happy when they have all three in abundance and in balance. And they notice that they're not very happy if they're missing one or more of those macronutrients. Just like you won't feel well physically if you're missing one of those macronutrients from your nutritional profile. So those are the three. Now, enjoyment, is pretty obvious, although there's a big literature on what it means. Satisfaction is tricky because satisfaction is the reward and the joy that comes from a job well done. And as Mick Jagger sings, I can't get no satisfaction. The truth is you just can't keep no satisfaction. And because that's the way your brain is designed, is to make you run and run and run and run and run. And I do a whole lot of research on how to break that. In the book, I actually talk about the formula for breaking the back of that tyranny. And finally, purpose or meaning actually requires challenge and trauma and hardship and pain, and actually requires unhappiness, paradoxically. So these are kind of complicated phenomena, but all together, everybody can get better at getting happy if you've got the knowledge and skills.
So tell us a little bit about that formula.
So the formula, the formula is, as I just mentioned, is, you need to be looking for enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose. But there's also the habits to develop for the people who are the happiest people. Now, the habits of the unhappiest people are that they maximize four things: money, power, pleasure, and fame. Art, prestige. Most people don't want to be famous, actually, but they want to be admired. They want the prestige. So that's the formula that people think will bring them happiness and just does not. That's the formula for chronic dissatisfaction. And your grandma told you that, but your grandma's always right. The real formula that we need to pivot to is, and these are the habits, this is based on 10,000 research articles, and so I'm boiling the ocean here. But the habits of the happiest people is that they think every day about putting a deposit in four accounts. This is important. This is retirement wisdom here. These are the 401k accounts for your happiness. And that's your faith, your family, your friendship, and work that is not necessarily paying work, because a lot of people retired listening to this. It is work that where you earn your success by, in other words, you're creating value with your life and you're serving other people who need you. Faith, by the way, is not necessarily a traditional religious faith. Mine is, but not everybody's is. It's a sense of the transcendent, something bigger than you. Friendship is pretty obvious. Family, the ties that bind and don't break and that we don't choose. And God knows in many cases we wouldn't choose, but these are the people that we can count on. These are the four accounts. What I'm talking about, it's start your spiritual journey. I have a whole chapter in this book, how to start your spiritual journey. How to recultivate the root system in your life for your family. If you're retiring and if you have adult kids, call them. Establish this relationship. You need to go move near them if you've got grandkids. I'm going to live in Florida because it's warm and there's golf. No, that's not going to bring you happiness. Like being near your grandkids is going to bring you happiness. Friendship is critically important. There are a lot of people who are retired today, older people who they don't even know how to make friends. Successful people from Wall Street, they got tons of deal friends, no real friends. And I talk in the book, I have a whole chapter about how to make real friends, not just deal friends. And finally, meaningful work where you serve other people. Those are the secrets: faith, family, friendship, and work. Those are the habits of the highest happiness people.
And your point on friendship, you had a great conversation with the Surgeon General of the U.S., Vivek Murthy.
Yeah.
Two-time Surgeon General. About loneliness. I'm wondering your comments about what gets in the way, and that loneliness isn't just for older people. You talked about your own experiences about being 19, French horn player, leaving college, and these things come up at different points in our lives.
They do. And Vivek Murthy, who is President Biden's Surgeon General, he's a phenomenally successful and excellent Surgeon General. He was also the Surgeon General under President Obama. And I asked him one time, what's the biggest public health crisis? I asked him during the coronavirus epidemic, what's the biggest public health crisis? He didn't say the coronavirus epidemic. He didn't say the opioid crisis. He said loneliness. Loneliness is killing tens of thousands of people indirectly every year and creating untold misery. And no matter how you measure it, it's at all-time highs. People have fewer intimate friends. They hang out less with people socially. A higher and higher percentage every year, people say, no one knows me well. And this is true across lots of age groups, from young women to older men. This is ubiquitous. Now, it's concentrated in certain demographic pockets. And one of them that's most interesting is the strivers, people who work hard. They tend to be really lonely. Leaders tend to be really, really lonely. And the reason is because they don't know how to make real friendships. it's funny, you know, all these people say, I had all these friends all the way through my career and I retired. I went from who's who to who's he, you know? And it's like, because they don't care. They don't care. If you don't cultivate real friends, your deal friends are going to be nowheresville, man. And so this is one of the key things that as people are working toward the second curve of their lives, they need to cultivate these friendships. And I talk about actually how you do it. You talk, you know, and this is based on the research. It's not just my advice. The research on how people can relearn the skills of authentic friendship later in life.
So you mentioned strivers and high achievers and the difficulty that they can have with the second curve. What does the research show and what's your experience in terms of making that transition in the second half?
So strivers are an interesting group because these are people that get no sympathy. Nobody feels sorry for a successful person. And, you know, we live in a country and we live in a time, we live in a world where we glorify worldly success. You know, people who have money, people who have power, people who have a lot of fame or prestige. We actually think that if we got the thing that those people have, that we would be satisfied permanently in our lives too, not thinking very hard, because we know in our hearts that no, that's actually not the secret to happiness. But people who have that, we think they must be really happy. And so we don't feel sorry for them. They say that they're lonely, but they're, you know, some of these people are intensely lonely. I talk to leaders all the time, and there's all kinds of interesting research on this. For example, CEOs, and there's a very interesting study by the Nobel Prize winning social scientist Daniel Kahneman at Princeton, where you live. And Danny Kahneman's work shows that the in an average working woman's day, the least pleasant interaction that brings the most unhappiness is actually time spent with her boss. Now, that has nothing to do with the quality of the character of the boss. This is that people feel tense around those who supervise them, those who judge them, those who evaluate them. And so it's important for strivers and bosses and CEOs and people who just have management responsibility to recognize that it's very easy for you to become lonely unless you have real friendships with people outside your work. And that's the critical thing that we have to, and that's one of the key ways that we can actually step from one curve to another. You need people with you. You need to have people along the way with you.
You mentioned before difficulty, and we humans tend to shy away from difficulty. And what role does difficulty play in happiness?
Well, one of the biggest mistakes that we make is that we're going for good feelings all the time. And we get kind of hooked on good feelings. And you know, the society tells us increasingly that if it feels bad, get rid of it. You know, just like in the 60s, they used to say, if it feels good, do it, which was pretty bad advice, pretty life-ruining advice, as a matter of fact. But now, when I look at my students, for example, they get, you know, mental health advice that if you feel rotten, then it's something you automatically must treat. And in many cases, there are maladies and mood disorders and mental health issues that really, truly must be treated. But unhappiness, per se, is a normal part of life. Negative affect, bad feelings, fear, anger, disgust, sadness. This is part of a full life. And the truth of the matter is that if you run away from those things, you won't find enough meaning in your life and you won't get that pillar of happiness. And so in avoiding unhappiness, what you paradoxically do is you avoid happiness. Don't shy away from difficulty. On the contrary, look, everybody listening to us is, you know, cares about life after retirement. They think about their own success and they're not afraid of hard things for sure, at least not in their professional lives, but they might be plenty afraid of those things in their personal lives. It's the same principle.
So you mentioned faith before.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how spiritual growth is a part of the second curve.
It's an interesting phenomenon as a social scientist. You know, there are so many things that we don't embrace. The superstition, people tend to become less superstitious as they get older. That seems sort of childish, but they tend to get more religious as they get older. And part of that is that they're looking for some sort of transcendental meaning. They recognize that life when you're only thinking about me, 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 is just so boring. It's like watching the same television show over and over. My car, my food, my money, my job, my television programs, my commute, blah. You just make it stop. And the way that you make it stop is you zoom out to the mysteries of the universe and where your place in it is rather small, but it's extremely interesting adventure. That doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to be traditionally religious, although that is perfectly fine. Even if you're studying, if you're an atheist who's studying Stoic philosophy, you can actually zoom out. You can zoom out to the secrets of life and the beauty that actually comes from understanding yourself in that particular context. And that's what people are looking for as they get older. They get hungry for meaning. They get hungry for answers. They want the answer to why. Now, early on in life, a lot of people reject spirituality and they they reject religion because young people are kind of rigid absolutists. They tend to say, look, you tell me about this God who's all loving, but I see all these people suffering, aka people, you know, their lives are rotten. So therefore, there is no God. Obviously, you're wrong. Your religion is all upside down. It's not right. And you get a little bit older and you're like, yeah, everything's pretty messy, actually. There's lots of things that don't have solutions that you can't put them in neat boxes. There's lots of things, you know, I'm not even who I think I am half the time. And so I'm just simply not going to rule out these supernatural phenomena. And that's why people actually, between interest and acceptance of messy realities, people actually get a lot more interested in religion. A lot of people go back to the religion of their youth and they establish a kind of a grown-up version of their faith. It's actually very beautiful to see.
So we can learn a lot from different spiritual traditions. And you write about the four phases of life in Hinduism. What's the third phase about?
So the ancient Vedic wisdom, Hindu wisdom from many thousands of years ago, about 4,000 years ago at least, talks about the perfect life. And it's a word in Sanskrit called ashrama. And ashrama is quarter. And the four ashramas are, you know, how they design a life of meaning and purpose and happiness. The first is what's called brahmacharya, which is the student phase, learning about life. It doesn't mean going to school necessarily. It means learning about life. The second is grihastha, which is known as the householder phase. And, you know, in Hindu wisdom, the householder is the person who works for a living and gets married and has kids and makes money and has all these worldly rewards. And the worldly rewards are, you know, the glories of the world and the pleasures of the world and the money and all that kind of stuff. And whether you have a lot or a little, you still like it. The trouble is that people get stuck in that. They get stuck in that second quarter. There's two quarters to go. And people who are really suffering are stuck in that second quarter, which is the fluid intelligence curve. It gets back to what we were talking about earlier. They get stuck on that. That's what made me successful. So I'm going to beat the dead horse and try to make it come back to life again and again and again and again. But that Hindu wisdom says that's not right, that there's two more quarters to go and you better jump, man. The third quarter, which they say, which in ancient Hindu wisdom starts around age 50, is called vanaprastha. And vanaprastha in Sanskrit actually means literally retiring into a forest. Now, this is a retirement wisdom podcast. And so, you know, maybe we should talk about retiring into the forest wisdom podcast, but that's actually a little bit too literal. What it means is starting to step back from the world's rewards and starting to think about bigger things. It's kind of getting in training for the spiritual verities such that you can get to the last quarter, which, you know, technically is age 75 to 100, and we should all live that long, which is called sannyasa. And that's the period of real enlightenment, which is the fruits of your spiritual and your transcendental journey. But it requires that third quarter. It requires the stepping back. It requires moving from being the ace to being the teacher. The master teacher is the one who's honing her or his craft in passing on truth and wisdom. It's so beautiful, actually, because it maps exactly into what we're talking about. Grihastha to vanaprastha is fluid intelligence to crystallized intelligence, but it's how the ancient Hindus talked about it.
So as a master teacher, what have you learned about yourself in the teaching you're doing now?
I'm back to teaching. I actually was a teacher earlier in my career. I spent the first part of my career as a professional classical musician, and then I went and got my PhD in my 30s and became a college professor. And I spent 10 years as a college professor before I took over this think tank, was a CEO for 10 years. Now I'm back to teaching. And what I find is my teaching is just much better than it used to be. It's easier. The words come easier. I understand the questions faster. I'm able to take ideas from a bunch of different literatures, blend them together and spit them out in a way that the students are like, how do you know all that? It's like, I don't know. I'm old, man. And I'm able to crystallize ideas in ways I just never, it's like, Joe, it's like magic. It's the craziest thing. I don't understand it. I couldn't have done it 20 years ago. You know, 20 years ago, I was writing math that I can't even understand today. But I couldn't lecture like I can today. I couldn't write like I can today. And the truth is that doing this research made me step into a crystallized intelligence role. And I'm happier than I've been in a long time.
And your column in The Atlantic, Never Miss One, How to Build a Life, great info. How does that help you and how does it help others?
Well, here's a secret about everybody who does the science of happiness. It's not research. It's me-search.
That's really what's going on. I know practically everybody who's doing science of happiness research, and it's because they're looking for it. You know, they're seekers. They want it. Some of them are happier than others. Some are kind of lagging behind, but they know this truth, which is happiness is like anything else. It's not enough to wish for it. You got to work for it. You know, people say, hey, I wish I knew more math. Well, it's simple. Go study math. I wish I were happier. Simple. Go study happiness, apply it to your life, share it with others. That's the secret to actually becoming happier. And so doing this work, you know, writing a column in The Atlantic about the science of happiness, this is not an opinion column. I read 15 long-haired academic journal articles every week to prepare a column on some topic that's in my mind that I think is probably in other people's minds. And it's positively inflecting my happiness in a huge way because I'm becoming more of an elite happiness athlete. So serving me, I get feedback. It's just unbelievable. I get, you know, emails every single day from strangers who are telling me that it's helped them. And that's because it's very helpful to learn about how to be a happier person. You know, it's no surprise. And it's not me. It's really the content. And to be a conduit for the content with my crystallized intelligence is really the great professional privilege of my life.
We appreciate you doing it. And one book that made a big impact on me was Richard Rohr's Falling Up.
Yeah, sure. That's a great book.
And he writes about the stumbling stones, the hero's journey.
Yeah.
What's the flip side? What are some of the stumbling stones that you might currently be trying to navigate?
Well, the stumbling stones that I talk about at the beginning of the book are the recognition that we're missing a step, that we don't have the energy that we had. We don't have the analytic capacity that we used to have. We don't have the speed, the accuracy that we used to have. And that stumbling is an incredible opportunity. It is an amazing opportunity that we can't miss, is the whole point. But it, like everything else, like Richard Rohr writes, you can look at these things as negatives, or you can look at these things as opportunities. Look, all of us have an opportunity, and I think an obligation to see our life as a startup. I mean, the ultimate startup that we have, I mean, there are people listening to us who started companies, and that's great, but that's trivial compared to the startup of your life. And the startup of your life has, you know, looks for explosive rewards, and it puts capital at risk and has faith in resources that are not currently in hand. And you should see your life as a startup enterprise that you're working on for the rest of your life. And one thing that all startup entrepreneurs have in common is that where everybody else says, oh, that's terrible, woe is me, how unfortunate, entrepreneurs say that's a big opportunity. And the same thing is true for us in our lives. We have to reframe stress. We have to reframe challenge. We have to reframe problems. And when we do that, really, there's nothing that's off limits.
So you mentioned transcendental before, and our oldest daughter was married in Vigo, Spain, Galicia.
Nice.
In 2019, pre-pandemic, way back in the day.
Yeah.
So I walked a 3-mile stretch of the Camino for a week back and forth, but you walked 100 miles of the Camino. I was wondering if you could tell us about your transcendental walk and what you learned from it.
When I first stepped down as CEO, I stepped down on June 30th, 2019, and July 1st, I flew to Spain. Now, Spain is my second home. I married a Spanish girl 30 years ago, and I worked in the Barcelona Symphony, and it's a place where I spend a good deal of my time. And so I speak Spanish, and it's a second territory for me. But what I wanted to do was to profoundly interrupt my experience. And I'm a Catholic. And one of the things that Catholics know is that the best meditation is walking. It's kind of, walking is Catholic exercise for the soul, sort of. And the most important pilgrimage for Catholics, spiritual pilgrimage for Catholics, is called the Camino de Santiago. The Camino de Santiago is an 1,100-year-old, so 1,100-year-old pilgrimage that originally started in Paris and went all the way to Santiago de Compostela, which is a city in northern Spain. And it's extraordinary. Now, most of it right now is from the French border over. It's an 800-kilometer walk, but people do various sections of it. And two times I've done 160-kilometer chunks of the Camino de Santiago. And that's what I did when I first retired, and I walked. And it was only, I did 1 week of it. I didn't do a whole month. I did 1 week. And I walked, and I prayed, and I thought, and I didn't look at my phone. And it was, man, it was amazing. It was a miracle. I started to notice little things that I'd never seen before. I did it again this last summer. I couldn't do it in 2020 because everything was locked down. But I was writing this book in 2020. And in 2021, I did it again, but I did a different one from the Portuguese border all the way up to Santiago de Compostela. And I'm telling you, it's a tonic for the soul. Walk without your devices. Walk for the sake of walking. Walk when it hurts. Walk when it's boring. Walk when the destination is unclear. Walk when it's raining. and dedicate all of the discomfort for, you know, as fruit of a labor that you don't quite understand. Be in the moment of indecision and notice the small things of life. And I'm telling you, it's like, you know, there's the Buddhists have always talked about the walking meditation, but the ancient spiritual masters of every tradition talk about how this is a very important analgesic to the stress that actually comes from ordinary life, because you're no longer distracted from actually being alive.
Catholic exercise.
Yeah. Catholic exercise, but, you know, for the inside and outside.
So during the pandemic, which I know is still ongoing, my wife and I had the pleasure of watching one of your classes where you invited the Dalai Lama, His Holiness, who you've had a relationship and friendship with many years. I'm guessing it would take hours to, or maybe days, to explain what you've learned from him. But I was wondering if you could share one or two key lessons that you've learned.
Yeah, over the years, over the past 10 years, he's been my mentor and teacher and a friend, and I love him for, you know, all the wonderful things he's done for the world and not just for me. And every time I get together with him, I usually interview him in public and I ask him questions that I think about for a long time beforehand. And then he says whatever he wants, whether he's answering my question or not. He, whatever I ask him makes him think about something he wants to share, and he shares, and it's much better than anything I could have shared. So I've learned a lot from him over the years. But the most important thing that I've learned from His Holiness the Dalai Lama is that the secret to satisfaction is not getting what you want. The secret to satisfaction is wanting what you have. I mean, we all have a lot, and everybody listening to us, there's nobody listening to the Retirement Podcast who is not, probably very few are missing three squares. The key thing that we all have in common is that we want more, 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 more. I mean, the secret to success is more, more, more. The secret to satisfaction is having a haves management strategy, is having more. And it's like, no, that's not right. The satisfaction is not what you have. It's what you have divided by what you want. That formula shows you that you don't need to manage the numerator, because you never can. You can never have enough. You need to manage the denominator. You need to chip away the wants in your denominator. And when you want, when you decide that you're going to want what you have as opposed to having what you want, you will find lasting and stable peace and satisfaction. And that's the what he's reminded me of many times, and what he's told me, and what he told me in the interview that you actually saw, which was one of my leadership and happiness classes at HBS. And that it just touches my soul every time. And unfortunately, every time he tells me that, I'm like, ugh, I forgot that again. Ugh, I forgot that again. Because it's easy to forget. But that's the big lesson.
Well, we really appreciate you sharing your wisdom with us today. Very, very helpful. Gives us a lot to think about.
Thank you. Thank you for the service you're doing for, you know, all of us who we're going to retire and we need plenty of wisdom. So this is always timely.
Thanks again, Arthur. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Joe.
We covered a lot of ground in that fascinating conversation with Arthur Brooks. And I'm wondering, what got your attention? What are some of the things that you noted for further thought or to take action on? There are five I noted that I'll share, starting with number one, jump the curve. And this refers to his commentary on the two types of intelligence, fluid intelligence, which declines with age, and crystallized intelligence, which goes the other way. So accept that things like your processing speed, one of those first curve attributes, will inevitably decline. But that opens up new doors if you embrace and explore the second curve, the things that improve your ability to synthesize information, make meaning, and teach others on help them how to make meaning themselves. These things come to the forefront, and as he noted, this second curve lasts for decades. Takeaway number two is see your life as a startup, and not just any startup, as he mentioned, the ultimate startup, the one you'll be working on for the rest of your life. So take advantage of the opportunity to reframe the challenges you face, rethink how you experience and handle stress, and then see and seize the opportunities that lie ahead. Number three, rethink satisfaction. This is one I'm going to have to give further thought to, but it resonated and certainly is important. And I'll include in the show notes an excerpt from his book where he goes into detail about the equation he shared. But what jumped out to me was the opportunity to get off the hedonic treadmill of wanting more and more. And instead, focus in on managing the wants and ultimately to want what you have. Big opportunity there, I think. Takeaway four, take a hike. talked a lot about the benefits of walking that really go far beyond the physical benefits, but the meditative benefits of walking, something to think about, something to experience. Give yourself time to zoom out, get a broader perspective, and as he mentioned, notice some of the smaller things in life. And number five, build the habits you'll need for the second curve. Make those deposits in those four key accounts he mentioned: family, faith, relationships, and work, in whatever form that is for you in the second half of your life and along that second curve. Thanks for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You'll find more information and links in the show notes, and you can see all of our episodes and hear all of our episodes at our website, retirementwisdom.com.
Just one more thing before you take off. Is it time to design your new life after you graduate from the world of full-time work? Go to retirementwisdom.com and schedule a call today with Joe Casey. Working with an experienced coach like Joe can help you explore new possibilities and gain clarity on your future. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. See you next week.
Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.